This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Hello, this is Jeanette Lafeve, your guest host tonight on People Speak Radio. I'm filling in for Bassema Farhat. At the People Speak Radio, we believe when people speak, they make a difference. You can listen to the People Speak at BBS Radio Live every Tuesday night from 8:55 to 9:55 Eastern Standard, or tonight Eastern Daylight Time. You can also listen from our website at peoplespeak.com live, or visit the iPod-ready archives of previous shows. Our show is live and broadcast in the USA, Canada, Australia, and the United Kingdom. You can call in with questions during the show at 1-415-762-1160 or at 1-712-432-0075. Enter access code 318116. Now, you can also listen via smartphone, so we can bring you the best people wherever you are. Tonight, I'm here with former Ambassador Edward Peck. He will be the fourth member of the flotilla, the humanitarian Gaza to flotilla that we have spoken with. We interviewed Jean St. Ange, Janet Coburn, and Joe Metter on June 8th, Ambassador. And, I understand you were on the same ship they were.
Yes, ma'am. That is absolutely correct.
Okay, well, we're very honored that you had time to be with us tonight. I've done some checking, and you seem to have had a very busy schedule since your return.
I must admit, it's as busy as anything I have ever known, ma'am.
Well, we do appreciate you taking the time, because your credentials are quite impressive. I'm not going to go through all of them. This is the short list: Chief of the Mission in Baghdad, Iraq, 1977 to 1980, served in the Foreign Service Office in Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, and Egypt, and as Ambassador of Mauritania. At the State Department, you served as Deputy Director of Covert Intelligence Programs, Director of the Office of Egyptian Affairs, and a Special Assistant to the Undersecretary for Political Affairs. It says here you also served as Deputy Director of the White House Task Force on Terrorism in the Reagan administration. Now, I'm not sure if are you currently the President of Foreign Services International?
Yes, ma'am, but I'm not sure it makes a great deal of difference. It's a very small company.
No, well, we just like to, know who we're talking to and keep the credentials straight.
Absolutely.
Now, and because I'm going to ask you the same questions that I asked Jean and Janet and Joe, but you have an impressive background in foreign service, and particularly in this region. And one of the things we've heard through the media is these people were naive, idealistic, they had no idea what to expect, they didn't understand the situation. And from what I read, that could not possibly apply in your case. So with your background, would you tell us, why did you choose to be a part of the flotilla?
Well, I'll tell you in total honesty, if you look at the record, I have spent most of my adult life living in or working on the Middle East as an American diplomat. And they taught me to speak Arabic, which is not an easy task for most folk. And so this is an area of the world in which I have spent an awful lot of time talking and listening. And, since retiring, Jeanette, I've taken and been part of a number of groups that have gone there to talk and to listen on all sides of all questions. And when the offer to participate in this flotilla came along, I spoke at some length to my wife, and I said, look, here's a chance to do something a little more meaningful than words. And so I took part. I mean, I thought it was a chance to make a contribution that had something visible, something tactile, I guess is the word to use. So that's why I went.
Okay, now I have seen in some other interviews that what literally amounts to an accusation that this flotilla was deliberately provocative, that it wanted confrontation, and you were not really allowed to speak real clearly. Can you explain to us what you saw the purpose of this mission as being?
Sure, and I know I don't need to explain this to you or to your listeners. There's no way in the world that I can claim to know what everybody else was doing. But my purpose was the purpose essentially of the organizers, which was to get humanitarian goods to Gaza, suffering from a ghastly experience since the caste led and even before, of being isolated from, separated from the rest of the world and being punished for the fact that they elected people that Israel didn't want. And you may know that the U.S. definition of international terrorism, the legal definition of U.S. definition of international terrorism, includes a specific reference to efforts to coerce or intimidate a civilian population, and that's Gaza, and that's international terrorism by our law. So I wanted to see if we couldn't get some humanitarian goods in. I also hoped, and that was the fuzzy puppy part, Jeanette, that you referred to, that maybe the Israelis would seize this as an opportunity to do something that would make them look like good guys, you know. Let in the humanitarian goods, keep out the people because the Gazans didn't need them, but it would look good. And yet I was very fearful in the back of my mind that Israel would once again demonstrate that it's not interested in looking like being good guys. I didn't expect it to get as bad as it was. But the thing that interests me is that there has been a tendency on the part of the American media, at least, and certainly the Israeli government, to paint all 600 participants in this thing as having exactly the same intent. Well, I've never been with a group of 60 people that had that. So, but those were my ideas, to maybe call some attention to the fact that these people were suffering from a man-made disaster as serious in its effects as the natural disasters in Haiti, in Chile, and in China had, but which got all kinds of international attention, whereas the people in Gaza are suffering without anybody really paying much attention at all.
And in my observation, when they do pay attention, they tend to blame the people in Gaza for the situation. During the course of this, of course, we've seen that they've tried to define everybody there as terrorist, and of course, I saw that myself. And then the other thing they've done is the blurring of whether the Now, with your experience, I can ask you this. The legality of the blockade in the first place and the legality of enforcing the blockade while still in international waters. These lines are being really fuzzed up in the media, going, well, under certain circumstances, under these conditions. And frankly, even with my experience and my understanding of the situation in the Middle East, and I do speak a little bit of Arabic, and you're right, it's very hard to learn. I won't try you on it because I'm sure you can swamp me. But with your experience in international law, and my understanding is you also helped develop some of the law on terrorism, in your understanding, is the blockade of Gaza legal?
Well, no. In the first place, you know, I'm not a lawyer, ma'am, but the occupation of Gaza is illegal. That is not Israeli territory. That is an illegal occupation from, you know, every definition that you come up with. They have no right to be there. And, of course, they're not occupying it. Ha-ha, they withdrew, except they control the airspace, the water, and the land borders, and can go in anytime they wish to with their airplanes and their tanks and their soldiers. So if that's withdrawal, then we are not speaking the same language. So they don't have any right to do what they're doing. And to enforce it way out in international waters is also a violation of international law, not to mention what they did with the people on the ships, you know, killing some, wounding others on our boat, as you've already heard, and your listeners have heard. There were some people physically hurt, but, you know, not seriously, but not critically. And you can't do that. I guess the best way to put this into focus is to point out that now Israel has announced that they're going to have not a list of things that can go in, but a list of things that are banned and everything else can go in, indicating rather clearly to anybody who's paying attention that this whole thing was punitive. You guys, you Gazans, you did not elect the people we wanted, which is the position taken by the United States. Sorry, you may have had free and fair democratic elections, but you did not choose the folks we wanted. By the way, I was there in Gaza in 2006 as an international election observer with UN status, and everybody certified, yep, it was a free and fair democratic election.
Yes, I was familiar with the fact that the election had been certified internationally, and I do realize that our media keeps talking about the Hamas takeover by force of Gaza while they just don't bother to mention, but it was because they were elected and then not allowed to take the jobs they were elected to by the U.S. and Israel. And this was, I remember this a lot differently because, again, this is something I followed for a very long time. In fact, I followed your flotilla before it ever left port. Oh. And I was up at 6 a.m. on May 31st and was stunned when I read that. And I shouldn't have been because I'm also very familiar with the USS Liberty incident and a number of others, and I guess I shouldn't have been stunned that there was bloodshed, but it still made me kind of sick to the pit of my stomach.
Go ahead.
The other thing was, of course, we've all seen the video that was released by Israel. At the same time, we're told that Israel confiscated every bit of video from every passenger. It was never returned. But we're supposed to take it on good faith that the video we're seeing is an accurate representation of what happened. Since we couldn't be there and we can't see everybody's video, at the very least, can you tell us what you experienced on the ship? And as an ambassador, I would expect you would have gotten something like special treatment.
Well, when the boat docked, there was somebody there from the Israeli Foreign Ministry to meet me. To escort me off to my gentle interrogation and expulsion. By the way, speaking of legalities, when we got on that subject, I was fascinated when I got to the place where the man said, here, sign this document, and people who had been through this before had already told me what it said, but I said, I can't sign that. It's in Hebrew. And they said, sign it. And I said, I'm not going to sign a document that I don't know what it says. And he says, if you sign it, we will deport you, expel you, and if you don't sign it, you go to prison. And our little group had already agreed that we would all sign it and go home, but they changed their minds in the process, the other three, and only Joe and I were. Anyways, but I said, why am I being expelled? And this man looked up and he said, you have broken an Israeli law. I said, really? What Israeli law have I broken? And he said, you have entered the country illegally. And I said, now hold it. You captured our ship by force in international waters, and you brought us here under armed guard, and I have just been marched ashore against my will, metaphorically speaking, with a gun in my back and my hands in the air, and you tell me that I've entered your country illegally? He said, yes. And I said, well, we're not using the same language, because, you know, you forced me to come here. I didn't want to come here. But nonetheless, I was expelled. So the legality question is interesting. But what we're talking about, if you've been watching this for a long time, on our ship, I opened my eyes and the commandos were in the room where I was sitting on a chair. This was quite a small ship, as your listeners have learned. So the commandos were able to step off the deck of their boat onto the deck of our boat. They didn't have to come down from the helicopters. And I looked up and there they were. And as you may already know, they wore balaclava masks in addition to their arms and equipment and helmets and stuff. All we ever saw was their eyes. And for us, it was over. The few of us who were in this particular part of the boat, one deck up on the top of the ship, the people who tried to provide passive resistance were the ones who got roughed up. Gene and Paul and others got pretty badly tussled. Because the commandos don't fool around. I was, you know, the thing that has interested me, and you referred to it, is that everybody on that big ship was accused of being a fundamentalist Shiite, of an Iranian-backed Muslim terrorist killer. And on a number of the shows where I have appeared, when they asked me about that, I said, well, what exactly was it that you expected them to say, to describe us, that we were all tree-hugging pacifists?
Yes, I saw that quote in one of the reports that I was checking through.
Of course they were going to put it in the worst possible light for us. And I'm prepared to accept that some of the people were prepared to give battle, but I think an awful lot of what we're talking about is the ship was filled with 600-plus men, women, and some children who did not want the Israeli commandos to capture their ship by force and take it into Israel where they did not wish to go. And it has fascinated me, and perhaps you as well, that the media keeps talking about how these poor, peaceful soldiers who had just come on board the ship to feed the pigeons, you know, were attacked by these savage. They were defending the ship. It was the Israelis who were attacking. And if somebody appears at your door masked and carrying weapons, you know, you're allowed to defend your house.
Well, that, I agree. That's one of the things I found fascinating. And of course, the discussion I had on this, I pointed out to them that one of the things where I hear constantly is the passengers were stupid for resisting. You know, they knew the guys were armed. They, you know, even though it was illegal for Israel to board, even though it was a violation of those people's rights, they should have just gave up. And it occurred to me as an American that it's so odd to hear people say that people fighting for their rights should just sit down and shut up. Weren't we taught that when people stop fighting for their rights, it isn't long before we don't have any?
Yeah, well, that's what we've always been taught. And, of course, a lot of the people, and we see them in our daily lives, some people are pretty fiercely combatant. Others tend to be, you know, more pacifist-oriented. But in this particular case, when these guys are coming down the, you know, and the, by the way, you do know that some of the videos that were made by passengers have since been released?
Yeah, I also saw that there was a live feed being broadcast from the ship that the Israelis weren't aware of right away.
But you know, it's perfectly understandable, although deplorable, that the Israelis have tried to bend all the information. It's called a spin, you know, to have it come out so you guys look good and the other people look like bad folk. But it was on our ship, the commandos were tough, they were mean, they hurt a bunch of people trying to get them away from the wheelhouse. And Paul DeRudy in particular got pretty badly roughed up. But when the ship docked, the first ones down the gangplank were the people who'd been injured. A guy on crutches, people limping, people with their arms in slings, a neck brace, a bandage on the head. You know, because these are soldiers. They don't fool around. And it was another one of sources of great interest that the Israelis said that these guys were armed with paintball guns. Yeah, well, any country in the world, and certainly not Israel, is going to send its troops into harm's way armed with paintball guns. Those things were fastened to the top of their automatic rifles. We saw them.
And I've also looked enough into your background to know that at one point in your career, you were a U.S. Army paratrooper.
That is
so
correct.
You would recognize weapons and be able to differentiate.
Yeah, there were no question about the weapons, and they used stun grenades, and Joe Metters, that wonderful guy from the USS Liberty, who's the only person I know who has twice been attacked in international waters by Israeli forces, got hit with a paintball and was wearing the T-shirt with the big blue and yellow stain on it when they put us on the plane to fly us home in Tel Aviv.
Yeah, I heard a rather interesting story about your flight home as well from Continental Airlines regarding your dinner service. In fact, I was really kind of curious about that. If you tell the audience what happened, then I have a question for you.
Well, the police kept us in loose confinement until the airplane left. That was about 6 or 7 hours sitting in a sort of a detention center at the airport. And then they took us out to the airplane, and the soldiers handed our passports and tickets to the chief cabin steward. And I was shown to my seat, a middle seat, and sat down and struck up a conversation with one of the gentlemen to my right. and the gentleman to my left was in his computer the whole trip, essentially. But anyway, when dinner was served, I asked for a bottle of red wine, you know, these little six-ounce bottles of red wine. And they said, no alcoholic beverages for you. And I said, oh, okay, why? I can pay for it. They said, no, it's not that. It's just that you're a national security threat. Well, if all it takes is 6 ounces of wine to turn me into a ravening monster, I guess they were right. But I thought that was kind of silly under the circumstances and fairly punitive as well. Later on the trip, I should mention the chief, the purser, the head of the flight attendants, saw me standing at the water machine getting a glass of water, and he said, if I were not in uniform, I would tell you precisely what I think of you. And I said, you just did. Don't bother. He was an Israeli, and he was very upset that I had done this.
Well, I understand the Israelis are upset, and I can understand why, because nobody likes to have criminal activity drawn attention to. And the fact that they boarded at 4 a.m. in black masks doesn't really seem terribly innocent to most of us. The average American is conditioned to believe that only criminals require the cover of darkness.
Yeah, well, it's a good time to do that sort of thing. You know, let's talk briefly about a related issue. I have always been fascinated by the reaction of Americans to the attack on Pearl Harbor, which was a surprise attack, right? And I remember as a young boy saying, well, what, they should have told us they were coming? I mean, that's what a surprise attack is. You surprise
them.
I mean, and Israel has done it, you know, a number of times in the Middle East, always describing it as a defensive attack, a preemptive attack, you know. So the Israelis doing that at 4 o'clock in the morning was good military maneuver. You catch them when they're least alert. So that was, you know, good military practice, and having your soldiers armed and prepared was good military practice as well. The fact that it was vile and, you know, and unlawful and all the rest of it, has got nothing to do with carrying out a military maneuver in which your troops could be exposed to danger. That's the way I would have done it if I had organized it.
Okay, so for the most part, it was a good military maneuver, but unless the videos, again, have been severely edited, they show us that lowering one commando at a time into an unknown crowd. And they tell us that the passengers were the first to shoot, but I'm not a military person myself. I have come from an extensive military family, and it would seem odd to lower your men into a potentially hostile or unknown crowd, even if you think they're friendly, without some kind of covering fire.
Well,
even shot into the air.
Some of the passengers said they were firing from the air as they came down. I wasn't there, so I don't know. And of course, we don't have the kinds of videos. By the way, you know, some of the things that they've smuggled out, that people got films and canisters in their pockets and things, are pretty grim, showing the soldiers carrying out some executions, if you will. And in the heat of combat, I suppose that sort of thing can happen. But unarmed civilians, they never did find any arms on that ship. If they had
The media has given a certain group of people who seem to believe in weapons on those ships in the same way they still cling to the belief of the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. That's one of the things I've been observing that I find a little disturbing. At what point? And so you spoke of Joe Metter several times, and I had the good fortune to speak to Joe. Actually, the date of our last interview was June 8th, which was just coincidentally the anniversary of his first experience with Israel. And coming from a Navy family, I wanted to extend to him that there are many of us out here who haven't forgotten and do realize that there's something horribly wrong with the way U.S. policy towards Israel is compared to our policy worldwide. Now, we have to take a break here in just a minute, Ambassador, but we will occasionally get questions from the audience. But I'd also like, because of your vast expertise in the area, and like you said, you've lived there, you know the people, from your expert point of view, what you think we can do at this point in time without totally upsetting every apple cart there is, to rebalance our policies in the Middle East.
Okay.
So if you want to take a moment to think about that, Don can, I hope he's listening.
I'll do it.
Okay, so because, like I said, I've followed the Middle East for many, many years for a variety of reasons I won't go into here, but, you know, when they pulled out of Gaza, you said that was an illegal occupation. When I heard of them pulling out of Gaza, I don't know if you had the same feeling, but to me it was just like, oh, yeah, take the settlers out of the line of fire and now you have a free field.
Yeah.
To me that was the, and maybe I'm a cynic, people tell me, oh, and the, of course, I'm anti-Semitic and Israeli hater and Jew hater. I get all of this and a terrorist sympathizer and supporter. How do you counter it when they accuse you of anti-Semitism when all you're trying to do is speak the truth?
Well, you know, I point out that I'm not at all happy and have been pretty critical of what the guys up on Wall Street were doing, but that doesn't make me an anti-capitalist. In the same sense that I get, you know, very distressed when people break laws that I tend to support, but that doesn't make me, you know, a rock hard, you know, kill them all sort of person. And Israel's policy, look, put it this way if I can, no one in their right mind, Jeanette, and I recognize that not everybody qualifies, but no one in his or her right mind wants anything bad to happen to one single person in the Middle East. I don't want one bad thing to happen to one Israeli or one Palestinian, one American. But the sad fact of the matter is that terrible things have happened, are happening, and are going to happen because of Israel's policies in Israel, in the West Bank, and in Gaza. And even General, you know, was just talking the other day about the fact that our relationship with Israel costs American servicemen and women lives and blood. And I know that that's true, and I also know that it's cost us status and credibility and respect and all sorts of other great costs, which are not to Israel's benefit and certainly are not to ours. And that does not make me anti-anything. I am pro-peace, justice, and recognizing, as I would imagine you do as well, that Israel cannot live in peace and security amongst her neighbors, which I would like to see, unless her neighbors are also living in peace and security. Because you can't do it by yourself.
Yeah, and another aspect of that is Israel stands on everything as their right to self-defense, but do not the other people in the area also have an equal right to self-defense?
No. And that's of course the whole thing right there. When you're the power, you can pretty much do whatever you want. And when they talk about, you know, the rockets were coming out of Gaza when it was still occupied, because you really can't stop that. A guy steps out of the shadows, you know, lights a fuse, there goes a rocket. How do you stop
that? Well, the same way we stop these guys getting guns and going on campuses so effectively in the USA or into the schools.
Exactly. I mean, you can't do it. I don't know when your break is coming up, but I once wrote a memorandum which I thought would carry some weight, a proposal that Yasser Arafat write a open letter to Menachem Begin, saying, you know, Mr. Prime Minister, with this letter, I commit myself to stopping every single crime committed by a Palestinian against an Israeli within 72 hours of you stopping every crime committed by an Israeli against another Israeli. Call me.
Do you know what year this was? Because, of course, I can name crimes that not committed by the government, by independent Israelis, like Barak Goldstein and,
just within Israel. You can't stop bank robberies and murders and assaults unless you know about them in advance, Mr. Begin. And I don't know what these people are going to do any more than you know what your people are going to do. So telling me I have to stop all of this, yeah, I'd love to, but how in the hell do I do it?
Tells me that you've got some interesting thinking going here, and again, probably due to your familiarity. Still trying to get a word from my producer here. So let's, you know, go into, you know, where you see we need to change our policies, and can it be done? Because there's a lot of people who view that America is so attached to its policy with Israel that any change is unacceptable and will bring down whoever makes the attempt.
Got questions? The library's got answers, and books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
Are you appalled that our country is spending billions on war while cutting funds for our libraries, hospitals, and schools? Are you heartsick at the suffering of the Iraqi people? Then join me, Medea Benjamin, in signing Code Pink's urgent call for peace in Iraq. Sign on today at www.womensaynotowar.org.
We teach them how to tie their shoes. They teach us how to live our lives. We teach them long division. They teach us how to bank online. Our children will always outgrow us, but for the first time in generations, they may not outlive us. Over the last 25 years, the percent of overweight children aged 6 to 11 has doubled. The percent of overweight teenagers tripled. Obesity kills. Heart disease, high blood pressure, diabetes, all are linked to obesity, a problem that could be greatly reduced just by having a place to exercise. Right now, people are working hard to put parks and playgrounds where children live, where children will use them. Finding out how you can help is as easy as tying your shoes. Log on to EarthShare.org now, a public service message brought to you by EarthShare and the Ad Council.
Can you imagine? Can you imagine having banks and credit that serve the community, solvent and free of Wall Street corruption, that create strong local economy and job growth? Banks that put profits right back into the local business and economy, not into far-off foreign investments or high-risk and exotic finance schemes of the super-rich.
Yes, we can.
Can you imagine eliminating income tax, ensuring economic stability, increasing social programs, and improving the standard of living for all Americans while paying off the federal debt?
Yes, we can.
That's right. It's all possible.
Yes.
Can you join us in working towards a solution utilizing principles suggested by our founding fathers through united action and strategies outlined in articles, blogs, and Wicca spaces where you can share and collaborate?
Uh-huh.
Please visit Ellen Brown's website, webofdebt.com, and help us make America's money and future of, by, and for the people once again. Can you do that?
Yes, we can.
Caution, if you are prone to being disturbed by real truth and real solutions, please continue to consult with your qualified Wall Street cheerleader economists on network television. Side effects for not visiting webofdebt.com include drowsiness, loss of job, loss of control of national finance, loss of country, followed by panic attacks and rude awakenings.
Hello, this is Jeanette Lafitte. I'm back with Ambassador Peck after a short break. Now, Ambassador, when we left off, we were just talking about what you feel in regards to American policy in the Middle East and the difficulty of unhinging a policy that we've been following for a very long time now without catastrophe to whoever puts forth the idea.
Yeah, it's powerful because we have in this country groups called lobbies. Lobby is not a dirty word. If you and I get together to vote for the, you know, some environmental issue, we constitute a two-person lobby. And lobbies are the way a democracy is supposed to work. The people express their views to their elected leaders. And in this country, we have a lot of very powerful lobbies. One of the most powerful is the pro-Israel lobby, which consists of a lot of people who are Jewish, Christian, you know, Muslim, atheist, whatever, who believe that we should be supporting Israel. And the lobby doesn't really have any serious, solid opposition because it's been working very effectively for the last 60 years to ensure that Americans have the view of Israel and its activities and its security that the lobby wants it to have. And so you get the political parties, there are really only two that count, being cringingly obsequious in the homage they pay to the lobby in its meetings and in their statements, and you get people like Mr. Biden, who is unctuous to the point of being sickening in the way he grovels for Israel, but the party
just
needs
to let
that
you
if
know,
they want to
we
get
have
votes
a caller
in elections.
On line
so
one. Caller
if the president
one.
Comes to power, Obama or whoever, and wants to try to change the policy slightly or even significantly, he runs head-on into the party and the Congress and the media and begins to see dimming chances of getting reelected, which is, of course, the most important thing for a politician is to stay in office. So I don't see any changes coming unless and until there is a very powerful and a very sustained counter effort not to abandon Israel or to, you know, put it in harm's way, but to reduce our vulnerability and the price that we pay for supporting Israel regardless of what she does. The classic example, I think, is the USS Liberty, where over 204 American servicemen killed and wounded on a U.S. Navy ship, and the American government did nothing. Are we there?
I hate to interrupt, but we do have calls. I did tell you some of our call, our people call in with questions. So we have a caller on line one. Your name, where you're from, and your question, please.
I'm Steve. I'm from England. Can I be heard?
Yes.
Yes, I hear you.
Hi. Now, first off, someone said a second ago that Obama runs into the media. Someone also said that public opinion, someone said that there was a vote, to get votes, he has to be pro-Israeli. When I speak to Americans, I don't hear an awful lot of pro-Israeli emotion in what they're saying. I think that the emotion actually comes from the media. I think the media builds American public opinion and tells Americans what they think. And not only tells Americans what they think, represents what all Americans think as well. So what I'm saying here really is that I'm not sure that when you say he's got to do that to get votes, you're dealing with anything other than what the media makes people think. And someone was saying that there's a we here. What can we do to rectify what America's doing? But it seems to me like the entire of America is more or less economically enslaved through poverty and the control of natural resources. Is there actually anything that such a desperately overworked and under-resourced population can do against or to withhold its government, to hold its government back?
Okay, Steve, hold that thought and give the ambassador a chance to respond, please. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, Steve, you know, there is no question in my mind that the American media focuses on what the people want to read, which is why we have all this attention to celebrities or wannabes, and doesn't give them too much that they don't want to read about. Now, I often introduce myself to audiences when I'm speaking as a Middle East expert, and I say I can say this with some confidence because, unlike the overwhelming majority of Americans, I at least know where it is. And we are justifiably not famous for the breadth and depth of our interest in and awareness of the rest of the world for a lot of reasons we don't need to go into here. So the media does feed it to us, and the media is largely concerned with making money. It's a capitalist society. So if you put stuff in the paper that is going to cause people to A, withdraw their advertising, or B, cancel their subscriptions, and they tell you about it in large numbers, then you're not going to put that stuff in, or you're going to fix it so it comes out in a way which is palatable to them. This is what a democracy is all about, of course, that people express their desires and their wishes and their preferences in a number of different ways, and they often vote with dollars, so that the American Congress is very aware of the fact, frighteningly aware of the fact, that there are people out there who will organize votes to defeat them and put money into the process unless they vote the right way. And in the field of foreign affairs, the support for Israel ranks number one.
Okay, Ambassador, I have some questions, too, from other people who weren't able to connect by phone, from Thomas in the U.K. Ambassador, especially from your professional perspective and your familiarity with the area, do you think anything positive has been achieved from the effort to break the blockade and from the incident that resulted?
Well, you know, there's some humorist once said that the most difficult thing to predict is the future. And I think that's probably true. It is clear that it was not my intent, actually. My intent was, as mentioned at the beginning of your show, to bring some humanitarian goods in and raise awareness of the rest of the world to what's going on there, and Americans as well. I didn't want anyone to be killed or to have all the disasters and the woundings and all of that that took place. But it is clear that as of this moment, there is a great deal of increased awareness of what is going on and what is not going on in the Middle East as far as the West Bank and Gaza are concerned. The West Bank news doesn't make the headlines much because it never has for the last 20 years, what's going on there and in East Jerusalem. But that is an upside. I am sure that you saw that they picketed an Israeli flag ship in San Francisco Bay Area a day before yesterday,
yes,
was it?
Yeah,
which
so
is part of this.
I read about that.
Yeah, part of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions effort to get Israel to focus on the fact that the rest of the world does not like what is being done to the Palestinians. Now, will that have an effect? It could. Supposedly, it was of dramatic impact in South Africa, which was a different kind of situation. But there's a certain level of misinformation also operating in Israel as well, because Israelis don't pay a great deal of attention to the West Bank, and they're not really allowed to go there. And if they do go there, they drive on their settler-only roads to the settlements and back. And as they become aware of the isolation that is sweeping down on them and all of the dislike and disrespect that they are garnering because of what they are doing, the flotilla, at considerable cost, may have been, to quote Winston Churchill, not the beginning of the end, but perhaps the end of the beginning as far as what Israel is doing out there and America's involvement in it.
Okay. Now, I have two questions from Abdullah from Texas, and you've pretty much thoroughly answered them anyway, but I'm just going to let you know, Zahida, that the Palestinians get a lot of support from ex-U.S. diplomats, but it only seems to happen after they leave office, and that the U.S., the rest of the world, has vocally condemned Israel's attack on the flotilla, but the USA has been rather lightweight in its condemnation.
With your reference to people talking up after they leave office, I used to train and teach young diplomats after I retired. When you're in the business, what you need to do is work towards the objectives that you think are important. And if you remember that nobody in the State Department makes foreign policy, the Secretary of State does not make foreign policy. She or he makes an input to the decision makers, and they say, okay, our policy is this. So after you get out, like General Zinni, the retired Marine Corps commandant, who, on everything I know about him, he was always a very outspoken man, but he kept his comments in-house, not like General McChrystal just did, so that you can speak more freely when you get out. But one of the reasons that my career was perhaps one of the reasons that my career was less successful than it might have been was that I told people what I think. This is not a good idea for the following reasons. Okay, now you tell me what you want me to do, and I will do it to the utmost of my ability. And if I can't do that, then I have to resign. But you speak up more easily after you've left. And it's not just diplomats. It's people who work in corporations, in the government, in the military, in education, whatever. Because when you're in, there are certain rules, and when you're out, most of them are gone.
Okay, and I'm glad you mentioned that, because I ran across an article you wrote a long time ago regarding your foreign service during the time you were in Algeria. You titled it, Doing the Wrong Thing for the Right Reason.
Oh, my goodness, you saw that, yeah.
Well, I think it speaks to some of what you were just saying about the limitations imposed on foreign diplomats. I was wondering if you could just concisely tell the audience what happened there and why you acted as you did in that situation.
Yeah, I was in Algeria as the head guy of a four-person consulate on the coast of the Mediterranean, the west coast of Algeria. And there were no Americans anywhere around. And an American woman came in one day and asked me to give her a statement that she was not married because she wanted to marry her Algerian boyfriend, and that he, following French law, had to produce a document that he wasn't married. And I explained to this young woman that Americans can't do that because the laws, the marriage laws, are done by states, not by the federal government. In France, it's a federal marriage license. So that in her passport, it doesn't say whether she is or isn't married, and I couldn't do it. And she was very upset with me and angry because I was being a stilted bureaucrat, and finally she began to cry. And so what I did was, what I was not allowed to do, I did a big statement with the seal and the, "Hi, Edward L. Peck, American Consul, have examined passport number such and such and so and so, and find no reference in it whatsoever as to whether she has or is now or has ever been married." And I put the big wax seal and the stamp and the red ribbons and all of that. And knowing that nobody in Algeria was going to read the damn thing anyway, but I wasn't allowed to do that, you see. But what I said was that I don't know anything about this. So I was doing the wrong thing for the right reasons. I never saw her again, but she was so thankful. And I always felt that I did a good thing by giving her a piece of paper that would look like what the Algerians want, and they didn't really care what it said.
But it goes back to the fact that the diplomats don't make the rules, but you do deal with the people.
Oh, my goodness, yes. Some of the things that, anybody who's dealing with rules and regulations, just the other day I went through an airport where the Transportation Security Administration guy said, "I'm sorry, madam," to the woman behind me carrying a 20-month-old baby, "but all footwear has to go through the x-ray machine." So she took off the little knitted booties and put them through the x-ray machine. Everybody kind of giggled and snorted, but the guy was doing what the rules are, all footwear.
So, bureaucracy tends to take on a life of its own after all.
Oh, my goodness,
And sometimes, like I said, I followed the situation with Israel for many, many years now, and sometimes their bureaucracy takes on more than a life of its own and seems to have layers to it that I find incomprehensible compared to our system. I mean, we know what our bureaucracy does.
Well, of course.
And we know how to get to the bottom of it. But there's, like I said, I've encountered so many things in your history, in your background, and it talks to us about a man who lives up to his ideal of an American. And this is something I saw in Joe Metter two weeks ago when I asked him if he regretted his service to the country given how the country has treated him in return. And he didn't hesitate a moment to say no, he would do it again. He took an oath to defend this country against enemies foreign and domestic, emphasizing the domestic.
Yes.
And I was in that struck me when I was reading on your background that you have some very values in common with Joe. Can you fill us in a little bit more, or am I wrong?
Yeah, no, that's okay. What I should tell you, that Joe definitely is the kind of person who is upset with the treatment accorded by his own government, accepting, I think, I'm not speaking for him, except on the basis of what I know, that what the Israelis did to him, they did, but what the U.S. government did to him and didn't do for him and his comrades is what he's upset about, foreign and domestic, as you say. No, I should mention, by the way, that the American Foreign Service Association, which is the professional organization of American diplomats, is the only organization in the entire U.S. government which does and has for 38 years given awards and recognition to people who stand up and challenge the system from within. You're not allowed to go public. You're not allowed to go to the congressman. You sit and you talk and you fight the problem inside the system, and you don't even have to win, but the award goes to people who've had the courage to step up and say, "Hey, this is wrong, policy or management." And nobody else does this but the Foreign Service, the diplomats.
Oh, well, that's very impressive. And again, this is a lot of things Americans don't understand about how their own Foreign Service works.
Jeanette, they don't understand anything. They don't know what we do. And they're not really very interested. That's one of the things that's fun. And when I lecture for the military, I said, hey, come on, you guys come back from overseas and your friends back home say, well, where were you? Oh, really? What about them Dodgers? You know, they don't know.
Yeah,
that's what I
saw a lot of it in the run-up to Iraq, people not knowing the difference between Iraq and Iran, and just all, it boggles my mind as well.
Oh, but my goodness.
I'm running short on time here, so if there's anything that you wanted to get out that I haven't touched on, I haven't asked you about, that you feel is important for people to know in regards to this issue, the Middle East in general, now is your time, Ambassador.
Okay, well, thank you, because one thing I would like to say is that people say, you know, that people, America has to compel Israel to do this or stop that or whatever nonsense. You know, what are you going to do, threaten them with war? Countries, just like people, only and always do what they think is in their best interest. They can be wrong, you know, and they can be coerced, but if they don't think it's in their best interest, they're not going to do it. So America, the only thing America can do that would be productive is to loosen its bonds to Israel so that we don't have to defend everything they do, regardless of how atrocious it is. That would take away some of the stigma that costs us lives and money and status and prestige and credibility and respect. And that's what I would urge Congress to do. Stop with the $3 billion a year in free money for arms, because it's an entitlement. There's no study of the threat. There's no study of what's needed. Here's your $3 billion bucks. And if you remember that in our program of $250 per family to get the economy running, every single man, woman, and child in Israel gets four times that much for no good reason at all. And it's every year. It's an entitlement. So if you stop doing that and you stop the slavish support of every atrocity they commit, even if it's committed against Americans, that would take us a little bit out of the line of fire, because as most people know, the testimony in front of the 9/11 Commission by the U.S. intelligence community said those people did what they did because of hatred over the way we support Israel in doing what it does.
Now, do you, like I, foresee that if we don't make some kind of shift, however even moderate, in our policies, that we will have future 9/11s, regardless of who's president or to what degree we step up national security?
I hope I'm wrong, but I'm afraid that you and I are both right. Here's the key thing. Israel, everybody wants everybody in the Middle East to live in peace and security, including Israel. But Israel will never live in peace and security unless her neighbors are also living in peace and security. And that's something that they don't seem to understand, or no Americans either, because you can't do it by yourself. If nobody else is living, you know, unafraid and in peace and comfort and all of that, then you can't either. And that's where Israel is making this tragic mistake. I hope I'm wrong, which is going to lead to the disaster that Peres and Ehud Barak and Olmert have all talked about, of winding up either with an apartheid state, which the world will not tolerate, or a non-Jewish state, which the Israelis can't tolerate. You can't do what you're doing. It leads to a disaster, and too many prominent Israeli leaders have said this. For anybody to blame me for repeating what they've said, I just happen to agree with them.
Well, I've heard the same myself. I've seen the comments, and I agree. And unfortunately, I think Netanyahu is a different kind of Israeli leader, because I remember back in 1988 his speech to Bar Ilan University, where he considered a third alternative as possibility. The world would stand by while they expelled every single Palestinian from Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza.
Yeah. And he has a man, Mr. Lieberman, his foreign minister, who still believes that.
And there's a number of Israelis, and again, I follow the chatter on the net, and there's people that really think that they can say this and that if we point out to the last time anybody advocated and acted on those policies, they ended up at Nuremberg, we get all kinds of kind of...
Oh, yes, I'm sure that's true. But, you know, it's our, we're right and they're wrong. It's the same thing that I ran into in that terrorism task force at the White House. You know, our guys are freedom fighters. Your guys are terrorists. And it depends upon which side of the border you're standing on. And if you remember that Menachem Begin, who won the Nobel Peace Prize, was a terrorist, and his people hung British soldiers from the trees and blew up the King David Hotel. And if tomorrow the New York Times carried the story, repeated the story about the blowing up of the King David Hotel, people would be outraged until they remembered
it was... Or the Jerry Epstein massacre, which I believe Begin was also responsible for.
Yeah, as a matter of fact.
So, yeah, this is not new. It's just that I think Americans are kind of stunned and can't accept it when this same hostility that is directed towards the Palestinians, and largely because they don't accept Israel's policies, is also directed to anyone else who disagrees with American policies, whether it be American or Brit or just about anyone on the planet, basically.
And it's unfortunate as the dickens. That's a silly way to put it. I'm sorry. It's a tragedy of galactic proportions that a nation like ours, which at least used to be the hyperpower, is slipping and sliding into these hostile actions against a people, the Muslims, who constitute the second largest religion in the world. What is it? 1.5 billion Muslims. They don't like what we're doing. For religious reasons. The Arabs don't like it for ethnic reasons. Europeans don't like it for democratic principle reasons. And we stand alone in supporting probably the most viciously anti-international law government around. You know, beating up on Myanmar is wonderful, but that isn't something that we support or facilitate. Nobody blames us for Darfur or Myanmar, but they do blame us for Gaza and the West Bank for good reason, because the raids are carried out with American helicopters, bombs, bullets, cluster bombs, and phosphorus. And I don't see any justification for that at all, particularly because I do not believe it's in Israel's best interests, a view that has been publicly stated by an awful lot of prominent Israeli leaders.
Okay, well, thank you, Ambassador. We so much appreciate you taking your time.
One bright sunny morning, in the shadow of the seawall, by the relief fountain, I saw my people. And they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering how if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.